You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Cadet. It's Friday, thank goodness. Time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our region this past week. Our panel today, Nicole Foy with Idaho Statesman, Troy Oppie with Boise State Public Radio News, and Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hey there.
Happy Friday.
Hi.
Hey, Betsy, I want to start with you. Governor Little earlier this week called a special legislative session that will start August 24th. Can you get us updated on why the session?
Sure. So there have been a lot of calls from legislators asking him to call a special session. We even saw a small group of legislators try to call their own session, which did not work, and they did not get a quorum. But since then, a number of legislative working groups have been convened that consist of the House and Senate germane committees on certain topics. And a couple of those have put forth legislative proposals, a couple of changes about election deadlines and how absentee ballots are opened in order to help county clerks deal with what they expect will be a really high volume of absentee ballots. There's also a liability reform proposal that's out there that's being debated again today. There have been other things talked about. Now, of course, it's completely up to the governor as to what topics a special session addresses, and only the governor under the Idaho Constitution can call a special session. So the governor has indicated that on Monday, he is going to issue his proclamation that officially calls the session and delineates the topics that the session will address. And he's made it very clear to legislators that he only wants to call the session on topics on which there is consensus language that legislators can fairly quickly address and enact into law. And certainly some of the things they've talked about have not been consensus. So it'll be interesting to see what the governor includes in his proclamation on Monday. Then the following Monday, the 24th, is when the session is supposed to start. Under the Constitution, special session can go for up to 20 days. Most special sessions I have covered have been only one day. So the talk around the State House seems to be it'll probably be 1 to 3 days.
So Betsy, I'm curious about, maybe this falls under the liability reform. There's been talk about some of these legislators wanting to come in and basically have the ability to not hold, you know, school districts, other, you know, places like that, not hold them liable during COVID. Can you delve into that? I mean, is that accurate or not? Because it's been bandied about quite a bit.
Right. So the Judiciary Working Group, which consists of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, and adopted and endorsed on a divided vote some draft legislation to absolve from liability. In other words, that if they were sued, the lawsuit would not succeed. All those, including businesses, schools, government agencies, and anybody else who during a declared emergency made good faith efforts to comply with laws and regulations, but, you know, something happened anyway. It's pretty broad. It is not time limited. It's not restricted to COVID-19. It was a proposed permanent change to the law. And since that was endorsed by the joint committee a couple weeks ago, there's been quite a bit of opposition rising up. And so today the joint committee actually convened, and I don't know what they ended up doing. They had 8 amendments proposed, all of which would in at least some manner narrow the scope of this legislation, possibly to limit it just to COVID-19, possibly to add an expiration date or to make other clarifications. So it's clearly a controversial proposal. The co-chairman of the working group, Representative Greg Cheney from Caldwell, said that other states have adopted blanket immunity for anything having to do with COVID-19, and he did not want to do that. He is an attorney, and he said that he doesn't want to protect bad actors. And he helped draft this bill along with Ken McClure of the Idaho Liability Reform Coalition, but he's now certainly entertaining changes to it. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out and if special session ends up addressing it or not.
Right. Yeah. And speaking of legislators, Senator Steve Thane made a comment earlier this week that many might say was controversial, to say the least, Betsy.
Indeed, yes. Senator Thain's comments came during the Education Working Group. And this was when the Education Working Group, consisting of the House and Senate Education Committees, was considering a proposal to make changes in who can order a school closed or who can order face masks or other preventive measures during a public health crisis. And they endorsed a proposal to say that only a school board or the governor, and I think there's one other in there, could do so, the State Board of Education, it would strip the State Department of Health and Welfare and all public health districts of any authority to issue any kind of order in that regard. So basically remove all their oversight of the spread of contagious disease in not only public schools, but also colleges and universities. It was a divided vote. It was 5-4 on the Senate side. It was a party line vote on the House side. And Senator Thain spoke out in favor of this bill. And his comments focused on how he's tired of hearing people say we should listen to the experts. And he said that he believes listening to the experts to set policy is an elitist approach. He's fearful that it leads to totalitarianism. And that America was founded, quote, on the idea that people weighed their own risks, did what they thought was best for their own interests. He said the role of experts should be to give us the best information they have and we should weigh it. They should never set policy. Now, his comments went viral. They've been talked about all across the country in newscasts about Idaho.
Right, of course.
With regard to the coronavirus. And I did speak with Senator Thain again yesterday, and he stands by his comments. He does not regret any of them. But he did tell me that if you deconstruct the phrase, listen to experts, that he believes some people mean by that, listen only to the experts I agree with and then slavishly follow their directions. So he clarified it a little bit, but he definitely stands by his concern.
Yeah. Well, you know, if I do need any type of medical advice, I do go to a person that's gone to medical school, not someone who has read a medical document. Nicole, I am curious about an article that you wrote recently in regards to Latino parents. And here's why. As we all know, some schools have already opened virtually. Some schools in Idaho are set to start next week. Many families are waiting to find out what that looks like. Is it online fully? Is it a hybrid? Are people going back? And to say that parents are nervous, I think is an understatement. And in this article that you wrote, though, you talked about Latino parents in particular wanting to keep their children home more so than white parents. But can you talk a little bit about that? Because I found this really, really interesting.
Yeah. So this was, you know, the latest story that, you know, the Statesman and the Idaho Education News have been trying to talk to, you know, Latino parents and families across the state about just education for Latino students. And of course, that has shifted our focus, just like schools has shifted dramatically with coronavirus. And so we actually started working on this article because we were seeing more than a usual very vehement response on social media, specifically in Spanish-speaking groups and from Spanish-speaking families, saying when there was all these discussions earlier in the summer with, you know, all of these schools must open, that Latino parents in Idaho really did not want to do that. And so some interesting data, this is a thing nationwide, about half of Latino parents across the country have responded to surveys saying that they are considering keeping their students home this year, mm-hmm. whether that's by doing online learning or figuring something else out. But actually in Idaho, Idaho Education News actually conducted their own comprehensive survey of this, and they found that 67% of Hispanic parents only 67% of Hispanic parents said that they would send their children back to school this fall, compared to 84% of white parents. And something else that's kind of interesting too is that this survey that they conducted was in English, and so it didn't account for Idaho's, you know, roughly 48,000 Spanish speakers who don't speak English very well. We kind of tried to do our own very informal survey, not as comprehensive as these other ones, trying to reach out to, you know, these Facebook groups and other people who we know have been asking questions in Spanish. And of, you know, 52 responses that we got with these very informal methods, we also got 50 parents saying, no, I don't want to send my kid back to school in the fall.
However, Nicole, with that being said, is that we know here in Idaho, at least, that's not necessarily an option for so many Latino families to be able to keep their children at home. Is it economic barriers a lot of times?
It is often economic barriers. Sometimes it also depends on, you know, we're hearing a lot just in general about, you know, sometimes there's not enough slots left in the online programs that are available. Mm-hmm. But another really key thing too is the availability of childcare. This same EdNews survey of Idaho parents found that 20% of Hispanic parents said that they have a hard time finding childcare compared to only 8% of white parents. And that's something that really, one woman who I spoke with, who her kids go to the Fruitland School District, she is very aware of the dangers of coronavirus. She actually was an employee at the Fry Foods plant in Ontario, which was one of the first coronavirus outbreaks that we saw along the Idaho-Oregon border that, you know, really made an impact on these communities. She didn't get sick, but she's aware of how dangerous it can be, but she has to work and she has young kids. She has an older teenager who can possibly help them. But even though, you know, it's kind of up in the air what the Fruitland School District is going to do, you know, she's not sure if she can keep them home, even if they're on our online things available. She said that she doesn't know much about online learning and computers, and she has to go to work to take care of her kids.
Well, and then you looked at it as well, Nicole. I mean, we also have to talk about the fact that, you know, then there are children that may be immunocompromised, right? Mm-hmm. And then parents are worried as well. So, I mean, there's just so many factors that play into this.
Yeah. And many parents readily acknowledge that they do not have a good decision here. Just Latino parents, just like many white parents, they don't have a good decision to make. You know, one woman who we spoke to who's in Meridian, like you mentioned, her son, you know, he's only 5 years old, so he wouldn't be going to necessarily full day school anyway, but it could be really dangerous for him if he catches coronavirus. But he also at the same time has a lot of developmental delays. And so not being in school might set him so much further behind where he should be. And so and not everybody, her family has the resources to be able to, you know, get him help and assistance and a lot of online assistance. But a lot of Latino parents in Idaho, if their kids speak mostly, if their kids are learning English and their family speaks mostly Spanish and they're supposed to be in an EL program, that's going to be really difficult to do online. And when you're not surrounded by 30 other children speaking English and immersing you in that language.
Right. Yeah. So Troy, when we talk about school, I mean, what usually goes hand in hand with the opening of school is fall sports, things like football. But it seems that school districts here in our area are kind of making up their own rules as we go with this. Can you talk a little bit about what this looks like from the high school perspective for some districts here?
Well, it looks pretty messy, to be perfectly blunt. So you've got the Treasure Valley, and then you kind of have everybody else. And you're crossing district lines, you're crossing health district lines, and in some cases, you're crossing conference lines in terms of how these schools and teams are organized by similar size and by geographic location. And so the big group in Southern Idaho is the Southern Idaho Conference. They have big schools, they have medium schools, and it gets further broken down like that. And the difference of opinion, if you want to call it that, between how these districts are looking at ways to operate safely by having games by having practices. Not everybody's practicing yet. It runs the gamut. The Idaho Statesman had a nice comprehensive list of what each one of these districts are doing. There are schools like Valley View that said a couple weeks ago, our foot's on the gas. We're going forward with this, and we are going to play games. Now, they might not have anybody to play, but that's kind of beside the point,
right,
to what they're doing. And so, you know, you have this mix of opinions down in the Treasure Valley. And just yesterday, up in Moscow, in northern Idaho, the Moscow School District has said, no, we're not going to have fall sports. We are going to play intramurals. We want to keep our kids in our buildings. They can practice. They can scrimmage. But we can't control the risk if we start, you know, going across to other communities. And obviously up there, they're crossing state lines. They're driving 2 hours for a game. Mm. It's a little bit different in communities that are more isolated like that. But the risk and reward for them does not work out, and they have canceled fall sports. So we will see if that is the first domino, and when maybe those dominoes start to fall in other places, because the situation is really, truly different all across the state.
Yeah, it's a really good point you make, Troy, though, about if that's the first domino to fall, because I believe also the city of Moscow was the first city to issue a mask mandate in the entire state.
I believe that's right. Yeah. And again, it comes down to, you know, these school districts and individual schools in some cases can say, yes, we're going to play. And it may just come down to there's nobody left to play.
To play, right.
We can't get any games on the schedule at all. And only time will tell, which is the most frustrating thing.
So Betsy, you know, as we went into this pandemic, me and everything started shutting down in mid-March, all of a sudden there was a real concern about state revenue. And where are we now? Because we have ended fiscal year 2020, that ended June 30th, we're into fiscal year 2021 as of July 1. Are we still in as dire of circumstances as I think many lawmakers were concerned that we would be in?
Well, so far, no. But there's still a whole lot of concern. The state ended the fiscal year with revenues sharply exceeding forecasts. It came out smelling a lot prettier than everybody thought that it would. And then in the first month of the new fiscal year, and that report just came out this past week, revenues in July came in much higher than expected compared to the revised economic forecast. Now, state economists have revised their economic forecast, and they are now expecting only 2% general fund revenue growth in the coming year. However, the state has cut a whole bunch of money from the state budget already. Essentially, they have front-loaded the cuts through the governor's 5% holdback. Mm-hmm. And so the cuts have been made and the revenue actually hasn't really fallen short yet. And the result of that is that if things were to continue as they are now, just 1 month into a 12-month fiscal year, Idaho would end this fiscal year with more than a $400 million surplus. Now, there aren't very many people who think that that will actually happen, including the state's economists. They are expecting revenues to really fall off. And they have a lot of explanations as to why the revenues were so strong in July that are related to one-time things. And one of them is that the federal income tax filing deadline was July 15th. Idaho's was June 15th because Idaho wanted to keep all its big revenues within the same fiscal year. But a whole lot of Idahoans, plus a whole lot of corporate tax filers, actually didn't file until July 15th. So they had a big revenue bump. But they also got more the month before. So things are looking pretty good so far. We also have $500 million in rainy day funds. The Little administration has announced plans to parcel those out slowly over 2 to 3 years. They're anticipating that state revenues will take an extended hit over that time. But basically the watchword from the administration has been, it's better to be prudent and cautious, and that's what they're being.
And in the middle of this, then there was an effort to recall the governor, and that basically ended up not going anywhere.
It did not go anywhere. It fell incredibly far short. Basically, there were tables set up at a few rallies, the John Birch Society rally in Twin Falls, and you know, a few other rallies around the state, and I think they claimed on Facebook they'd gotten 18,000 signatures and they needed 185,000, and the deadline's passed. So no recall.
So finished with that. What we are not finished with, unfortunately, is COVID. And our numbers, as we mentioned, are still going up. And Nicole, we're still seeing outbreaks in food and meat packing plants all around the state. You mentioned that first one at Fry Foods right on the border of Idaho and Oregon, and that was back in May. But where are we right now? Because it there does not seem that we've gotten a good hold on this within this industry.
Yeah, we've had cumulatively about a dozen outbreaks since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak in Idaho, in different meat packing and food processing plants, mostly food processing and food packaging plants here in Idaho. The most recent are two out in the Magic Valley area in Twin Falls and Heyburn. And you see a range of outbreaks still from, I mean, I think the smallest that we've reported on has been about, 10 or 11 folks who have tested positive to upwards of, 70 and 75 people. And, it doesn't necessarily compare, size-wise to how the big outbreaks that we've heard about on national news and in other states, particularly in the Midwest. However, health officials have talked about the fact that these outbreaks, especially in communities where a lot of people in the surrounding area work at these plants, appear to be driving, a lot of some of these counties having more cases than others. And it's particularly in the South Central Public Health District's health officials there have said that is what they're seeing as a very high, as one of the reasons for a very high rate of coronavirus in the Latino communities, especially in five of those eight Magic Valley counties that continue to have many Latinos testing positive for coronavirus. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing at the Statesman now is we're trying to track them. So you can go on our website and you can see, you can find a map and see where there has been an outbreak in your area. You can see the latest number of people who have positive. Whenever we report on these, we are very clear about how many people have recovered because we know that matters a lot to people. And also to be clear, even though there have been many deaths linked to these outbreaks in other states, the Statesman, we have not yet been able to confirm that there has been a death link to any of the outbreaks in these cases. But it's important to understand and important to track these because we've really seen them fuel very, very large coronavirus clusters, very deadly coronavirus clusters in other states. And so it's important to know where that's occurring in our state.
And then Troy, we are in the middle of summer, which means we are also in wildfire season, and we are seeing some fires here in Idaho. How are they keeping firefighters safe on the fire lines, or are we seeing firefighters and other people that work on the fire lines coming down with COVID?
Yeah, in fact, for the first time, just a couple of days ago, the Department of Lands pulled a wildland firefighter off the line at the Pumpkin Fire. That's the fire that's kind of burning up between-ish Horseshoe Bend, Placerville, and in that area. Thankfully, that is a very, very slow-burning fire. The terrain is really difficult, but they've been able to keep it isolated. And I just saw an update that's 40% contained now. But they did pull somebody off, send him home, or send the individual home. We don't know the gender, as well as the crew that they were working with. But they've obviously been working on these protocols now for a while. They knew this was coming. And so the groups have gotten smaller. They're sending out smaller crews together. They're sleeping on the fire line. They're not coming back to a large camp at the end of the day that's, hundreds or in some cases, 1,000 firefighters. They're in these small groups called spikes, and they're the terrain necessitates some of this for the pumpkin fire, I was told, but you know, they're airdropping food and supplies in to these small groups. So everybody stays isolated. And that also means that, you know, firefighters aren't going to the grocery store. They're not going to the convenience store. It's limiting their exposure out in the general community as well. So they have taken a lot of very specific measures to keep firefighters safe. Obviously, with the ease with which the coronavirus can pass between people, asymptomatic people especially, nothing's going to be perfect. And now we've seen a case here in Idaho. Washington State has had a case in a firefighter, California and New Mexico already as well. And we're certainly, I don't know if we're past the halfway point of the fire season just yet.
And Betsy, I think it's worth noting as well that we now have COVID cases in every single county in our state.
That's right. That was kind of a milestone that we reached this week when Lewis County, which is so small, it has fewer than 4,000 people, reported its first case. That was the last of Idaho's 44 counties to report a case of coronavirus. It is now everywhere. And interestingly, it's comparable to the Spanish flu epidemic or pandemic back in 1918, when despite quarantine efforts that were very strong at the time, that pandemic spread to every single place in the state where there were people.
Wow. A name that is back in the news right now is Adrie Edmo. And if you are not familiar with that name, we do have an award-winning podcast called Locked, and it went in depth into her case. So if you want to listen to that, you can go onto our website or wherever you get podcasts and listen to that. But Betsy, for people who do know about this case, Adrie Edmo had gender confirmation surgery, and she is a, she is a prisoner at Idaho State Prison. And this, what's fascinating about this is the cost around this, because a lot of people, including lawmakers here in the state, thought that we would basically be handing over so much money for surgery like this, and hence why there was a massive lawsuit.
That's right. And Idaho Press reporter Tommy Simmons looked into those costs. He has a story on the front page of today's Idaho Press, and it's quite the eye-opener.
Right.
The surgery itself, which has been completed, and Ms. Edmo has been transferred to the women's prison, cost roughly $75,000, but it did not cost the taxpayers a penny more because it was covered under the existing prison health contract that the state has to cover health services for its state prisoners. On the other hand, the state's legal fight against having to do this surgery has cost the taxpayers plenty. The current tally is $433,561.62 and counting. The case is still pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. The state has not dropped it. It seems like there's a possibility it could be ruled moot because the surgery has already occurred, but there may be interest in trying to pursue some kind of precedent-setting matter. We could be spending a whole lot more. It's getting up to $500 million in taxpayer funds for the legal fight alone, not for the surgery.
And, you know, it's one of those times too, where right now when so many people are in such financial straits, right? And so many people are out of work. And then you see that taxpayers are paying for this lawsuit.
This has been a personal priority for Governor Brad Little. He has pressed this lawsuit extremely strongly. He's been very outspoken in his opposition to the state paying for this surgery, which the state maintained was not medically necessary. The courts found otherwise, both at the federal district court level and at the appellate level. And it's possible that the U.S. Supreme Court will weigh in.
Right. Nicole, you've done a lot of reporting on the disparities during the pandemic when it comes to why our Latino population has been so affected by COVID. And this is not specific just to Idaho. We know that people of color have been so much more greatly impacted by COVID. However, there is so much misleading information out there right now in regards to why that is. Can you take some time to actually give us some clear facts as to why this is happening versus speculation as to why certain populations are being hit harder than others?
Sure. I guess I might just address the speculation that was in the news at the beginning of this week that was very well documented by Olivia at the Idaho Press. You know, a member on the Southland District Health Board suggested that maybe one of the reasons that Latinos or people of color are having are being hit harder by coronavirus, including in our state, could be because of vitamin D deficiencies. And that is something, I mean, something to understand is, of course, everyone knows the science is changing very rapidly with this. And there we have since come up with a list of things that can possibly affect how deadly, how fatal coronavirus can be for someone who catches it. We don't always know why someone has a more severe case compared to a lighter case. But this idea is very interesting because we do have a lot of data pointing towards why, in particular, Latinos and other people of color, and in some parts of the country, especially Black people, are really being hit hard by this. And it's been well documented. They're more likely to be working in essential jobs that have not thus been able to social distance even from the beginning of this pandemic. They're more likely to have a more difficult medical history because of a disparity in access to healthcare, whether that's they have to drive 20 miles to a good hospital or because it's been difficult for them to afford medical insurance in the past. There's a lot of things leading to this, and especially when you come to the Latino community, you also have a community that is can be very not trust authorities, and maybe not even trust going into the hospital because of fears of immigration implications for their family members. But in Idaho, we have also, like as I said earlier, especially in the Magic Valley, we have really seen, and health officials have said this, that a lot of the reason for why there seems to be a very big impact on the Latino community is because we have these big outbreaks in Idaho's agribusinesses, where people are close together, where it can be very difficult to social distance, and where there have been allegations. There was an OSHA complaint filed against the meatpacking plant in Burley that employers are not taking precautions. And when you have an immigrant population or a population that has experienced a lot of discrimination and disparities in the past, especially when it comes to healthcare, you're going to see what's happening right now. And on top of that, when you also have a state that really lagged behind in getting out information about the coronavirus in Spanish, it's not shocking that people may not have known what to avoid, where to go, or even some basic measures about how to stay healthy in your local area until it was too late. And that's something that's really important to understand. And also, when we're talking about vitamin D deficiency, I just want to say this as well, is that when we're talking about Latinos, not everyone is the same skin color. And I think that just needs to be said right there. And as someone who, as a Latina, had to take vitamin D pills when I moved to a very cold state in Chicago, if I would have known that would keep me safe from coronavirus, I would have ordered myself a full pack. But that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing that there's some very serious environmental factors and other things that I'm sure experts will figure out that is really driving this disparity in why Latinos in Idaho and across the country are getting hit by COVID.
Well, and we should note, one of the best ways to get vitamin D is sun exposure, right? Take a walk.
Yes.
And let's be very clear, and science backs this up, that Idaho has some of the most sunshine more sunshine than most states, right? So people get exposed to vitamin D. So that is a fact. That is a fact. Troy, before we wrap things up, I want you to quickly talk about where we are. We talked about high school sports a lot, even more talk about college sports, college football in particular. We know the Mountain West just announced no football. That impacts Boise State. But where are we with U of I? And then BYU, what? They're playing.
Yeah. So BYU, if you want college football, you got to go to Provo because there is no college football outside of Provo, Utah, at this point this year, west of Texas. They're independent. They schedule on their own. They're not beholden to a conference, and they're going forward. Idaho, so to take it back to last week, the Big Sky Conference, where Idaho and Idaho State both play, said, okay, we're not going to do conference games. Schools can go ahead. If you want to play and you can do it safely, you can schedule three games, non-conference games, on your own. Good luck. Idaho was looking around. I don't know. I mean, not to disparage Idaho, but I can't imagine any teams very excited to take a plane trip to Moscow during a pandemic. It's just not happening. So I don't know how close they came to getting any games on the schedule. Yesterday, the Big Sky came back to the table and said, nope, that's it. We're done. There's no fall sports of any kind within the conference. And that eliminated the end of that. The Frontier Conference, the NAIA conference, that's where College of Idaho plays. College of Idaho had already said, we're not going to play football this fall. And yesterday, the Frontier Conference made that a conference-wide thing, too. So all across the West, this is all done. BYU has two games on its schedule in September, one in October, and a fourth in November. And the big thing with college sports relative to high school sports, of course, it's opportunity, it's fun, it's normalcy, it's important. The revenue problem with college sports is mm-hmm. going to be big. Boise State is going to be out millions of dollars if they cannot get any football or only a portion of football played this year. And as the guest I had, the economist I had on Morning Edition this morning said, you know, these college athletic departments are going to have to cut costs, namely coach salary and other things, and they're going to have to borrow money. And those are the two things that they can do to survive.
It's going to be really interesting to see how all of this plays out, and no
and painful
intended. And painful. Yeah.
Interesting and painful. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Thanks, guys, for your time today. We've been talking with our panel of reporters, Nicole Foy with the Idaho Statesman, Troy Oppy with Boise State Public Radio News, and Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press. Appreciate your time. Have a good weekend.
You too.
You too. Thanks for having us.
More Idaho Matters right after this.